Welcome to the True Blue LA podcast. I'm Jacob Birch. Eric Steven is out on an 8-game suspension for thinking of throwing a baseball.
Yeah.
You're wearing the mustache, so you're allowed back in.
I'm saying, So what a week, man. This is, again, one of those things where we have a decent idea what we're going to talk about. And then, it kind of just changes suddenly, you know? So we were going to talk a lot about a certain suspension and incident. But it's a little bit back burner-ish, but we'll get to it, obviously. All we'll say is that we don't know whether Joe Kelly's going to serve his suspension this year or next year.
So we'll talk about why that is. We'll talk about the suspension itself. We have a Dodgers Rewind that I'm super excited for. A 5 questions from Craig, all of that after this. So this may be our most listened to podcast ever, Eric.
Wait, why?
I have an idea. What if all of the owners in baseball and their employees agree to, let's say, commission a leader of all 30 teams and imbue them with power, and this person could then commission rules and disciplines so that they can kind of form the behavior that they want the teams to take place.
Isn't it easier though to nebulously blame the other party? That seems like
no. As I'm calling them, the super captain of baseball would never do that. They would be a brave leader. Bold examples with humility.
So in this utopia, this leader would actually put the interests of the sport ahead of either side of any sort of dispute.
Oh, absolutely.
Man, seems a little far-fetched to me. I don't know.
Well, unfortunately, that the commissioner... So I only really know Bud Selig, also not very good. And Rob Manfred, has the commissioner always been bad? It's hard for me to tell, just because in 2020 commissioners, I assume, get way more rose colored as the years go by. You kind of forget how bad they actually were. Bud Selig's in the Hall of Fame, which is just nonsense. But have they always been this bad, or have there been good commissioners? Is this a thing that existed?
Yes, it's hard to say. The commissioner's spot came into being because of the Black Sox cheating scandal, and the owners are like, man, we got to get control of this, we got to bring this guy in and basically make him an autocrat, and that's what Kennesaw Mountain Landis was. He wasn't. He was hired, I guess, by the owners, but in a weird way, he wasn't as beholden to them as most commissioners are, at least especially now. But then also he was a virulent racist. Pretty much all commissioners are bad. There was also Bart Giamatti was very short and sweet. He actually died suddenly after banning Pete Rose, but also there was rumors part of the reasons the owners wanted him is because he was very anti-union when he was the president of Yale. So it's tough, man. But you mentioned, Bowie Kuhn, who was a terrible commissioner, is also in the Hall of Fame because you can just let anyone in, apparently. But you look back and when free agency was forming and players were actually finding their voice and actually organizing into a union, and all the owners had it their way forever, and all the quotes as it's going on, they're just so ludicrous, how little the owners thought of the players and management and stuff. And like Bowie Kuhn, whatever, who cares what his name was, but like Bowie Kuhn, like his, he was just especially bad and short-sighted, and they look even more ridiculous now. Like given how like the game is modernized, and you know the players do have a voice now. Although maybe after years of getting like beaten by Manfred in labor discussions, they have less of one, you can argue. But that's also why Manfred's commissioner, because for years he was under Seelig as like the lead negotiator in CBA talks and things like that. So now he's just heading the sport. What he really is the head of the owner side versus the players. And you that sort of adversarial.
Yeah, your job is representing the interest of gazillionaires. I suppose you're probably not going to be very well liked.
Well, the weird thing too about Manfred is like every time he speaks in public, he seems a lot more combative and like, I don't know, angry about stuff. Like, or just he doesn't, I guess he's, it's weird. It's like he doesn't like being challenged, you know, in a weird way. That's probably oversimplifying it, but he seems petty. And let's just say not the, probably a great like labor negotiator, not the best like leader slash mouthpiece for the sport. So like that's where the part of the problem is, I think. But yeah, that's kind of where we're at, and that's why we're part of the reason why we're in the situation somewhat. But so the main like crisis right now in the sport is the COVID-19 like testing. We recorded Monday, and the Marlins had just played the Phillies amid having, I think it was up to 4 players at that time, and they were gradually like getting more players like testing positive. It was a full-fledged outbreak. Now it's even more so. They're up to 18 players who have tested positive, and like they, you know, you on the trip you take 30 players plus 3 taxi squatters, so 18 out of 33 tested positive on that trip they were on. The Marlins are still in Philadelphia. Like this is Saturday, they last played there Sunday. So then the ripple, the part where it becomes a problem for the sport is the ripple effect. So they, like, by all accounts, like the Marlins and Phillies shouldn't have played Sunday probably, and they did. And then the Phillies had to shut down too. The good news is that since then, no Phillies players have tested positive. MLB reported today that 3 staff members did for the Phillies, but 2 of those were false positives. So there's like some, you know, optimism that it, like, okay, this wasn't like, it didn't spread, you know, that's where it gets like super dangerous, where it just like spreads like wildfire, and then wildfire throughout the league. But anyway, the Phillies were out of, you know, caution, and they didn't play all week either. They're not playing until Monday. The Marlins are next scheduled to play Tuesday. So that's 2 teams had week off, but that affected games with the Orioles, the Yankees, the Blue Jays, and the Nationals this week. And then so eventually they're gonna have to try to figure out ways to make up those games. And then we had a second thing. Cardinals on Friday were about to open up a series in Milwaukee. They had 2 players test positive. 4 more positive tests came out Saturday. I think of the 6, it's 3 players and 3 staff members. So the first 2 games of that weekend series have been postponed. They're allegedly going to play Sunday, but if you take the sort of the Marlins approach, you would imagine they might actually, you know, postpone more games. We'll see. But as of now, it's just Friday, Saturday postponed. So that puts up to 16 total games postponed because of the COVID testing. About that Cardinals Brewers series, Lorenzo Cain, like this morning on Saturday, he opted out of the season. He had already played, you know, part of the season, but now he's like, nope, gotta, you know, health of the family, that all that stuff. So he's out. I know we had talked about this in the past. There was confusion a little bit about if a player opted out, could he come back in? The answer was yes, but the deadline for that was yesterday, I believe, either yesterday or today, which is August 1st. I think by August 1st. So yesterday was the deadline. Nick Markakis, who actually opted out earlier, he did opt back in. So he's playing for the Braves. Now people who opt out, they're out. So like David Price out, but I don't think anyone's expected him to like change his mind given how vocal he's been. But yeah, so 16 games postponed, 8 teams affected this weekend, 20% of the league not playing. So like that's a problem. And the other thing is Jeff Passan at ESPN on Friday reported that they're like, it's weird how this gets, it's like Schrodinger's report basically is that this got reported that like Rob Manfred, the commissioner, warned Players Association head Tony Clark that if the league didn't get a handle on this, things could get shut down as early as Monday. Now, a lot of people's reaction to this was like, that seems dumb for him to like put an ultimatum and say it's all on the players. But I think on one hand, at first, like when I read that, like I didn't read it that way. It was more like they had a conversation and it was like, hey, we have to like make sure this works, right? It wasn't like, hey, dummies, like, you know, get your shit together. I don't think it was that. But then again, so part of that thing too, Keith Olbermann contributed to that report. He heard from people. He said, networks broadcasting MLB games have been alerted to look at possible alternate programming after this weekend should the league shut down. He later amended that to say that it doesn't necessarily mean they were going to shut down Monday. It was just that they were, if it happened, it could be as early as Monday. So now on Saturday, Carl Ravitch of ESPN, I guess he talked to the commissioner, and he said, he told Ravitch, we are playing. The players need to be better, but I'm not a quitter in general, and there's no reason to quit now. We've had to be fluid, but it's manageable. And like this is where it comes down to like, you know, okay, like masks are off at this point, and that's been part of the problem. But no, Manfred, like. The owners and MLB in general, they're going to take every opportunity to blame the players no matter what. That said, like, yes, like, players, there are definitely players, quote unquote, at fault for a lot of this because of their actions, but it's also part of a system that doesn't have, like, defined
rules or consequences and penalties. Or structure.
Yeah. So, like, and so it's really like, you really shouldn't do this. Like, it is basically the teeth of the operations manual. So, in fact, just pulling it up, conduct outside of club facilities, part of the operations manual, there's a point that says MLB will not formally restrict the activities of covered individuals. That's the players and coaches and everyone involved when they are away from the club facilities, but will expect the covered individuals on each club to ensure they all act responsibly. So like it's more like it's a stern warning. It's a talking to. That's all the operations manual like defines. Now players have taken it upon themselves to sort of like, try to do this. Like I think a lot of the veteran teams have done this. Like the Dodgers have pretty much from the jump been like they've been talking, I think, through the summer camp about, I don't know if they set down like rules, you know. They didn't like necessarily, but it's like they basically have the understanding that no one's going to try to screw this up, right? They're going to keep it in line. Now, the problem is we've seen a bunch of games on TV for over a week now, and players are still like celebrating because it's natural like to celebrate. You're going to high five. There's been not hugging, but like close to it. And a lot of players and coaches aren't wearing masks. And like, so I think like there was a concerted effort like last night. I think that was more to the point of that Manfred Clark thing to like get players on board. And like the Dodgers specifically, Justin Turner sent out a thing through Alana Rizzo, stuff they're working on. Nobody out of the lineup. Nobody who's not in the lineup is in the dugout during the game. The pitching coach isn't in the dugout while the team's on offense. The hitting coach isn't in there when the team's on defense. All the players cover their face while in the dugout, and we saw that with the Dodgers last night. no more high fives and handshakes. And then, I don't know, it seemed like it was better last night. We'll see if it continues. Now, the thing about this is, like, while that report seemed dire that, oh, my God, we could shut this down, there's like, too much money at stake for them to stop. Trevor Bauer, of all people, tweeted this, but it seemed to be pretty on point, basically, in response to the Manfred quote to Carl Ravage. And he said, look, the owners have their ideal situation, like fewer games, lower player cost, increased playoff increased playoff teams, and increased TV money. That's their dream scenario. There's no way they're giving this up. So, like, that's kind of where I'm at. Like, I think there's still too much money at stake for them to... It would have to be, like, so bad. But then, when we talked about this last week, what's the number, right? Like, how bad does it have to get before you, like, shut it all down? And it's, like, the positive part about this is that no Phillies were positive just yet. And so it's not, you know, maybe they're not necessarily spreading it by playing baseball. It's more what they're doing, you know, while on the road, I guess, is the main concern.
Yeah, so there's a lot of reports that right. Transmission in an inside environment is way, 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 way worse than outside. Yeah. So that would make sense that if a player gets it, players on that team are at a very high risk or sharing a hotel or whatever.
So it seems less dire than it did for about an hour or so yesterday or whatever that report came out. Because, like, oh, man, like, this could end all of a sudden.
That said, it's certainly non-zero, right? Because all it takes is one transmission and her team, and then that person is infecting everyone in the clubhouse. So
yeah,
I don't
want
to
exactly say,
let's just take this lightly. But
if
you want to cling
sure
to hope.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it could definitely get worse and all get shut down. But I think it has to, like... it does have to actually get much worse, I think, for that, which is weird. But then all, you know, for a little bit, we're like,
It is interesting to think of, like, I don't think it would actually have changed the outcome, but I think certainly maybe the reporting that if, of all teams, it was the Marlins, who not only are one of the least popular teams in the franchise, are also kind of one of the easier to, oh, it's just the Marlins. It's a Florida
right
issue.
But as it stands, they have the best winning percentage in the National League East right now at 2-1.
So. 2-1.
Yeah. The funniest part, like, I think Jeff Sullivan last night just screenshotted their Baseball Reference franchise page. And, like, as of right now, like, this is the only season, because they've never won a division. Both years they won the World Series, they were wild card teams. So, like, right now, this is the only year they're first in the division. Like, so it was, I thought that was pretty funny. Yeah. But we did have on-field stuff.
Oh, stuff. Yeah, the Dodgers did not have any games postponed, so some stuff happened.
Yeah, so
should we talk about Joe Kelly?
Yeah. So of all the people, right, to, like, to quote unquote get payback on the Astros, it was someone who wasn't on the 2017 Dodgers. He was on the 2017 Red Sox, who lost to the Astros in the division series, but that's neither here nor there. So Tuesday, the first game in Houston against the Astros, Joe Kelly came in the sixth. He on a 3-0 pitch, he threw well up and in to Bregman. I actually don't remember if it went behind him or not. I think it did because he ducked. But like it was, that was, you're like, okay, he didn't get ejected, but like, I think at that point I knew Kelly was going to get suspended and like, it was obvious, right? Like that, it was so obvious, but like, anyway, and then later in the inning, he on a knuckle curve, I think it was 86 point something miles an hour, he threw up and in to Carlos Correa, who took a little bit more offense. Bregman just kind of stared and walked to first. But then he struck Correa out, and they were jawing back and forth. I believe Dusty Baker said Joe Kelly's exact phrase that set Correa off was, "Nice swing, bitch." And then it just got kind of funny. Like, I don't know. Because Kelly was mocking Correa as he was going to the dugout, like he looked back, like nah, like it's hard to say it in audio form.
That's sort of a boo-hoo almost.
Yeah, and Joe Kelly later said, "I was just trying to like mimic what it sounded like I thought he was saying," so which is kind of funny if you think about it. Benches cleared in a pandemic where everyone's supposed to be social distancing, and that was like part of it. I actually thought MLB would, if they really wanted to get a hold of this, they would hammer like everyone involved. Like, you know, like you're not supposed, that is specifically laid out, like that if you like violate social distancing to argue either with an umpire or have an altercation, like that could be subject to harsh punishment. Doesn't specify what that's purposely nebulous, but still, like that one was actually defined and they didn't really suspend on it. So Dave Roberts got suspended a game because the manager always gets suspended in that case when a pitcher throws at somebody. It's like automatic. They specifically said it was for Kelly's actions why Roberts was suspended. Now, Kelly was suspended 8 games, which, like, I can't remember the last time a reliever got 8 games in a full season. And he got 8 games in 60 games. Everyone was kind of, like, a lot of people throughout baseball, like, thought, that is excessive, right? Like, Kelly appealed. Dave Roberts didn't. Dave Roberts got to watch the Wednesday game from a suite at Minute Maid Park. I was surprised. I thought he might have to leave, like go to the hotel or something. But like he was actually allowed to stay and watch. Bob Guerin managed. So Kelly is appealing. I would imagine that gets knocked down. But it was one of those. The gist of everyone's sort of like argument is that the Astros players didn't get punished for anything they did for cheating in 2017. And Joe Kelly is the one who gets punished for it. Alex Wood talked about it in spring training. He said, you know, someone's going to take it into their own hands and they're going to get punished worse than a team for the worst cheating scandal in 100 years. That quote got a lot of traction this week. But yeah, it's weird.
It's weird, right? Beanballs are stupid. It's the weird thing, right? Beanballs are stupid. Intentionally hitting a player is stupid. On the other hand, baseball has historically been extremely like weak-willed in punishing everything else, domestic violence, the cheating scandal, actually hitting players. You know, Joe Kelly didn't actually hit anybody. And on top of that, I don't want to say, there's no way Joe Kelly meant to do this either which way, but it is Joe Kelly who can't hit the broadside of a barn if he wanted to. So, I don't necessarily like 8 games for trying to hit, especially near the head of a player. I don't necessarily have a problem with that.
Yeah.
I think. And so that in isolation. Okay. But the problem is you haven't done it before. You're probably not going to do it after. Astros are still getting hit and actually getting hit. I doubt we see suspension for that. Or maybe we'll because it's the Astros. And I think that's the biggest thing is the first suspension since the cheating scandal is to what, through optics at least, looks to be protecting the cheaters. And that's just horrible optics at the very minimum.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely what this was. Like sending a message like you can't do this. Like generally baseball, like, you know, polices itself, as they like to say, and this is part of that. You know, it's not necessarily a noble part of that, but it is part of it. Like but I think MLB was trying to get out in front of it in a way, even though they set themselves up to this and they're in reality way behind because they sort of opened themselves up for this.
And I
with
think
their
the
weak,
problem
weak
is
punishment.
I think the big and thing where I was really sort of frustrated is they're trying to get in front of this and they haven't tried to get out in front of beanballs for a century of baseball. They haven't gone and tried to get in front of COVID. They didn't try to get in front of the Astros cheating scandal. So many things where baseball has just come across as weak, and this is like the time they come out as strong, and it just leaves a bad taste in your mouth.
So I think part of that is like they put out the big number to get the shock value to be like, hey, don't do this, right? We can't have this. But I think eventually it'll get reduced by appeal. But another thing is, I believe Evan Drellick reported this week that the players and the union and the owners agreed to give the commissioner power to actually punish players for like sign stealing or, you know, violating the rules to sign steal, because, you know, you could sign steal like normally, but like, yeah. So like that's a thing. So at least that was part of the problem with like, there were no rules. It's like the whole operations manual with COVID-19, like the rules aren't in place, right? Like there's nothing to enforce because you haven't designed them. So, and that was part of the problem. Also, they had to give players immunity to get anyone to talk. And so that, like, you set up a system that's just faulty from the start. So at least, like, going forward, like, they're getting the system in place, and that's, like, probably a positive. But, yeah, so that's sort of where we're at on that. And we sort of joke, I jokingly said earlier about whether Kelly will serve that suspension this season or not. I do think they'll keep playing long enough to where he will eventually serve that suspension. It's funny because usually these things are like they wait, not always, but like they wait till a player is like in New York for a trip or something, then they go to the league office and have their appeal. Sometimes it takes a while, but like now it's like everything's probably done via Zoom. So like I think they can handle that fairly quickly. So we'll see how long, you know, it might behoove them to like handle it soonish because it's going to go, well, at least it's expected to go down to 28 players, this Thursday, and then 26, 2 weeks after that. But just given some of the rash of injuries, and I think there were reports that the players and owners were like talking about extending the 30-man rosters for a while, which kind of makes sense. Like if players are getting hurt, and also you're having to deal with this outbreak where teams are needing to replace players. Like the Marlins, for instance, I don't remember the exact count. I think they've acquired like 6 players in the last week. I think they claimed like 3 or 4 off waivers. They traded for Rocky Blyer last night for the Orioles. So like, because they have so few players like who are actually healthy for, they're supposed to play Tuesday. That's the plan at least. So we'll see if that's still the case. But like they have to replace like a lot of people on their roster. So like, this is so weird. Like that's the other thing about like the competitive nature of the league. But this falls under it is just the Marlins. Like sort of like it's a bad thing to say. But like it really is. Like imagine had the team been like the Dodgers or the Yankees, like who had like, you know, 18 positive tests. Then, like, I think you would have been like, whoa, like, that's, what do we do now, right? Like, this is one of our World Series favorites. How do we figure this out? Like, not that, you know, obviously public health and the player's health and stuff should be, and everyone's health should be main concern. But, like, I would imagine the team itself also played into it. We'll see. But I don't know.
So other things happened on the field, including my next Dodger MVP favorite, Corey Seager, tearing it up.
Yeah, and so you might, like you said, you might have been even late. Not late, but like early on it.
I did say, I believe in this league shutting
down. No, yeah, they're insane. No, because if it shuts down, like, look, I don't think they would do awards, but like he'd be one of the favorites
for a 2-week season, like MVP.
Yeah, like Shane Bieber is the Cy Young because he has no runs allowed and 27 strikeouts in the American League. But yeah, Corey Seager. So like if you just look at his stats, right? Like it looks like a normal hot streak, like a really good hot streak. It's 344, 417, 688. He's homered in 3 straight games. But he's been so much better than that. Like, he's just absolutely stinging the ball. As it stands, his OPS plus is 204, which is great. Again, it's the Dodgers have played 8 games. So, like, whatever. But he leads MLB with 19 hard hit balls. That's defined as anything 95 miles an hour exit velocity or above. The second place person, I believe there's a few people tied, it has 14, so he's way up on that. He has 7 barrels. Now, this is like a combo of like exit velocity and launch angle, and based on like play-by-play data, it's plays that have an average of at least a batting average of 500 and a 1500 slugging percentage. So he has 7 of those. The next place person has 5. His expected batting average based on that batted ball data is .494. His expected slugging is 1,063. He also has the highest expected WOBA. He has been absolutely tattooing the ball, which gets me to this. You know, so Seager, you know, his expected batting average is .494. His actual is .344. So that's he's getting robbed by 150 points of batting average. Which Dodger was the unluckiest in batting average in 2019? And I will give you this hint. It says qualified on the page at Baseball Savant, but looking at it, it looks like I think the minimum is 300 plate appearances.
Okay. I'll answer that after this. Who was the unluckiest hitter on the Dodgers last season?
This is just batting average.
Right. So batting average versus expected batting average.
Yes.
Okay. So
their expected batting average is much higher than their.
My guess, and I'm only going to do one guess, because then I'm just going to start. You know, there's not enough. Yeah, there's not enough variable options for me to just keep going. Mm-hmm. My guess is Justin Turner.
That's not right, but
I'll take.
I'm trying to see where he is relative to the rest of the lineup. Okay, so he's not going to be.
Okay.
No, wow. Okay, well, I'm going down. So 5, 6.
You don't have to rub it in, Eric.
Oh, no. Okay. Oh, okay. This is funny. So I was trying to see where he ranked among the Dodgers lineup, but I was going down the whole MLB list. And so his expected batting average last year was .290, and his batting average was .290.
Oh, so wow.
He was the seventh on the Dodgers.
Normalized Dodger.
Yeah, exactly. So now the unluckiest was Max Muncy, 18th in MLB. He actually hit .251. His expected batting average was .274. So 23 points.
He would have been, he would have been up there on names I was scratching down. For some reason, I had Justin Turner's batting average as worse than .290 last year. But brain no work, apparently.
Cody Bellinger was second. He quote unquote only hit .305, but his expected batting average was .325. And that was his expected batting average was second in the majors. And the only person ahead of him, Howie Kendrick. 337. So his postseason run expected. Yeah.
Well, some other stuff has happened. When we talked last week, we kind of briefly mentioned it was so short notice, obviously. But we still wanted to note that at the time, both Mookie Betts and Cody Bellinger were struggling a little bit. We have some good news on one front, at least.
Yeah, I would say one of them still is. Cody Bellinger, not in today's lineup. We're recording on a Saturday. He's 5-for-36 and has looked every bit of it, with his swing and stuff. The Dodgers generally haven't hit much, but yet they were four outs away from being 6-2. Blake Treinen gave it up last night, aided by a Dave Roberts decision to intentionally walk Eduardo Escobar to get to Christian Walker. Christian Walker hit a 3-run double, and they went up 4-3. Then they added another run after that, so they're 5-3, which is, well, you look at it, it's funny, like, oh man, they're only 5-3, but then that's a 100-win season in a full year, and it's, you know, like, whatever. But who knows? But Mookie Betts is, like, slowly but surely, like, getting better. He hit his first home run last night. He also hit a double, and he had one of the better throws you'll ever see. It was in the first inning. Ketel Marte doubled down the line. He tried to extend it into a triple, and Betts threw, I believe StatCast said it was 305 feet on the fly, and it was awesome. And we talked too about generally how he's looked very, very good in the field. So that was fun. But yeah, it's just fun watching him play, right? It's very exciting, and he's going to be, he's under contract through 2032, and that's really hard to fathom. So the other thing that, like, just baseball sort of finds a way, keeps going. Roster churn, still a thing. So the Dodgers are on the road right now, but it creates a little bit more of an obstacle. It's why they have the taxi squad, or one of the reasons why, to have extra players available. And those players get to fly with you on the charter, so you're not, like, putting people on commercial flights or and this isn't a normal year because they're not, like, joining you from wherever the minor league affiliate is. So it's not, like, from Oklahoma City or from Salt Lake or whatever. But now the Dodgers have – this is another thing. It's not actually defined. Commercial air travel is discouraged but not prohibited.
Hey, the look, Dodger, another right, weak yeah, balls.
Right. So the Dodgers, though, are not having anyone fly commercially. So, but what that means is it's not like, congratulations, like Tony Gonsolin, you get a charter flight. No, he had to drive from L.A. to Phoenix. Now, the way Dave Roberts said this, because I believe I didn't explicitly ask this, but Dave Roberts said he was driven. And so in my mind, like, Tony Gonsolin didn't have to drive. Like, he could just concentrate. He started Friday's game in Phoenix. I don't think he drove, but because the way Dave Roberts says was he was driven. So maybe he was driven to succeed. I don't know. So the roster churn, on the road trip, they put Alex Wood on the injured list, shoulder inflammation. And the report on him was, I believe, don't pick up a baseball for at least a week and then go from there after that. So figure he could be out a little while. They found that out like Monday, and they brought Josh Spores with them on the trip. So like he didn't have to make an extra trip to join them, but he was in the bullpen for a few days. He was optioned to make room for Gonsolin on I'm missing one. So first off, that was Friday. On Thursday, the Dodgers called up Victor Gonzalez, who was on their taxi squad, to give them an extra arm in the bullpen for Gonsolin's start. And so, like, yeah. I'm sorry. He gave them an extra arm for Thursday, though he wasn't used. He was actually used Friday in his major league debut. And then today, Saturday, they called up Mitch White and sent Gonsolin down. So now Mitch White also had to be driven from USC, where the Dodgers' alternate site is, to Phoenix. I asked the other day, like, because I'm pretty sure they had this sort of planned, because I asked, like, was Gonsolin the only player in the car? Or I said, I think how I asked it was, is the person you're calling up or to add to the deck, was Gonsolin alone in the car? And Roberts said no at the time, but I don't know like what the deal is with that. But I assume White came with Gonsolin and they knew what was up rather than having like two separate trips. But who knows? But the point is, like, major league teams are still going to make roster moves, and it just sort of happens. So we talked a little bit about like how the schedule, especially for those teams in the East and now the Central, are getting like messed up, and they're gonna have to make up games somehow. And I think MLB, anticipating that there's gonna be more doubleheaders, the players and owners agreed, and it was announced yesterday that starting today, all doubleheaders will be two games of seven innings each. That's what they've done in the minors for a while, but it's weird. Which it also means they're gonna have the extra inning rule, runner on second base beginning in the eighth inning of those games. So yeah, it's weird, but like whatever. Oh, and the other thing is MLB will not recognize no hitters or perfect games of those games because they're not nine innings. so as someone pointed out, is a perfect game that's still scoreless, and then somehow the player, the pitcher, like either through a batted ball or pickoff, retires the runner at second. So he has a perfect game through nine innings and faces less than the minimum. That would be the greatest game in baseball history, I think, if that happens. So, yeah, it's going to be weird. So seven-inning doubleheaders, it's weird. That's where we're at right now.
I think it's time for Dodgers Rewind.
I think so too. And I'm
really excited for this. One of the when I started really getting into baseball. Like, I've been a baseball fan and enjoying going to baseball games for most of my life, but like when I really started like learning players' names and like watching every single day, who you've picked was a very early favorite of mine.
This falls under the we're scrambling to like put the show together, and I was definitely scrambling earlier today, and I go, oh, I don't have a Dodgers rewind yet, and I always try to like tie it somehow to like something going on, and I sort of found it here in two ways. One is that this year the Dodgers have only they've only had 8 pinch hit appearances in 8 games, so 1 per game. They're 1-for-7 with a double. AJ Pollock had the double. He's actually been hitting quite well. I also had a walk. They had 307 pinch hit appearances last year. Under Dave Roberts, they've averaged just over 2 per game. Obviously, the through line is that just removing the pitcher spot has essentially removed 1 opportunity per game. That sounds about right. But it's just an adjustment to be made. As deep as their roster is, they're not necessarily using pinch hitters a lot and going for, I guess more matchup stuff. I don't know. It's just been a little bit odd so far. But I guess we'll see how it continues. But the other thing is Edwin Rios in Houston. That was the other highlight of the week on Wednesday's game. The Dodgers played the longest. Dodgers and Astros played the longest game of the season. One of only, I believe, 2 of 8 extra inning games so far to go past 10 innings. They played into the 13th. And so Edwin Rios led off the 13th with Kike Hernandez, who made the last out in the 12th. He was on second. Edwin Rios led off the inning with a 2-run homer. And it was a bomb. And the Dodgers won that game 4-2. So they swept the Astros, as Dave Roberts put it. It was nice to get. He didn't say revenge. Maybe he was asked it, but it was like basically it was nice to get the wins on the field rather than they released a lot of tension, I'll say, in that series. The Joe Kelly incident, the getting the 2 wins, that was it seemed like a very productive series for their catharsis, or I guess in that regard. But anyway. So that's a 13th inning home run. One of the few recent Dodger home runs that was actually later than Edwin Rios' 13th inning shot was Almedo Saenz in 2004 against the Pirates in Pittsburgh. He had a 2-run home run in the 14th inning. And, of course, that was hit as a pinch hitter because that was one of his main things. Almedo Saenz, I didn't put it in the notes, but, you know, his nickname was the Killer Tomato, which is baseball nicknames, they just don't exist much anymore. And, like, that's a fun nickname. I always like that. Now, Saenz, he played some, you know, he wasn't just a pinch hitter, but he was a good power hitter for them. And with occasional pop, in his 4 years with the Dodgers, 2004 to 2007, he had 49 pinch hits and 8 pinch hit home runs. He hit 250, 320, 413 as a pinch hitter. Now, I have 2 trivia questions for you, Jacob. They're related. I will give you the first one first. Those 49.
That's rather odd of you.
That's like, God, I think it's a Mitch Hedberg joke, and I can't remember how it goes, but. The only one that pops to mind now is it's a fight to the finish. Well, that's a nice place to end. You know, like, but anyway, stupid. Saenz is 4th among LA Dodgers with 49 pinch hits. How many players above him can Jacob name? This is career pinch hits with the LA Dodgers.
LA Dodgers. I think I only have one name, and you and I were talking about this a little before there, before we started. Baseball has gone more and more to less pinch hitting, generally. And for the life of me, if this had been Dodger Rewind of somebody else on this list, I would have been able to say Almedo Saenz. I'm happy about that, but unfortunately, that one is who I'm benchmarked against. I have Manny Mota.
Manny Mota is one of the 3 ahead of him. He has 106 pinch hits with the Dodgers. He held the major league record for a while. with pinch hits. Lenny Harris has it now. I can't remember if John Vanderwall beat him first or not. But anyway, 106 with the Dodgers. Manny Mota's second. Do you want to know the other two, or do you have other guesses?
I do. I have nothing that's even close to a good guess.
Oh, okay. Okay. So man, you're in, I'll tell you this. I will. Let me ask you the second question then next.
Okay.
Sines had 15 pinch hits in both 2004 and 2006. That's tied for the third most by an LA Dodger, including two seasons from Manny Mota. He also had a 14 hit.
No, let me see Manny Mota again.
No. No. The reason why I'm not answering the other one is because this person is also here. So my question to you, can you name any of the two players with more than 15, LA Dodgers with more than 15
pinch hits in a season? This may be really stupid, but for some reason this is lodged in my brain that this was a thing that occurred. Mark Sweeney?
No.
Okay. It was just somewhere in there, like a different trivia that's getting mixed up in my head.
He had 12 pinch hits in 2008, so not terribly far off. Okay, so the person who tops both of these lists... 1993, Dave Hansen had 18 pinch
that
hits.
That wasn't going to come out of my mouth.
he has 110 pinch hits as an LA Dodger.
I wasn't going to think of it today. I have like a year that I can blame baby sleep deprivation for getting these things wrong, right?
Hansen also has the record, Dodgers LA Dodger pinch hit record, with 7 pinch hit home runs. And Almedo Sines, both of his 15 years had 3. So the other person with the 17 pinch hit season was Mitch Webster in 1992. And the other person that was the most surprising to me, the third most career pinch hits by a Dodger, LA Dodger, Chris Gwynn, 52, just ahead of Sines. Mitch Webster had 44. Andre Ethier has 40.
That's good. I spent a good 10 minutes before we went on there just kind of thinking of someone in the on your Ethier vein, not a bench player, but someone that was either hurt often enough or was just on the team often enough that they just happened to be taking days off and then would be the first guy up. I think if I had a day or two to think, I might have been able to tap into my pre-me watching knowledge and come up with Dave Hansen, but I wasn't gonna. That was as good as I was gonna do. I'm happy with my non-answers.
Nice. You can't go wrong with Manny Mota.
You never can. So it's time for
Questions to Craig.
We love it.
Man, you're making me screwing up my notes. I have to change my timestamp because we have to get that in. You would not be pleased if you weren't able to get your We Love It in. So there we are. First question. This is going to be mostly for you, Eric. After watching Mookie Betts for a week, it is clear he is a five-tool player, and I was trying to think of a time when the Dodgers had 2 five-tool players on their team, Bellinger being the other one. Then I got to thinking how many five-tool players I have seen on the Dodgers besides Raul Mondesi and Yasiel Puig, and he can't think of really anyone else. Who is he missing?
So, I never saw him play, but like, I guess Willie Davis didn't hit enough home runs, but he's probably close. I'm trying to think. So, Pedro Guerrero was always bad on defense, but he did have a couple 30-20 seasons in terms, so he had like some speed. But yeah, he's not there. This is a good question and one I don't have a ready answer for. The power and speed part like is the easiest sort of way to remember. And then it's trying to figure out if they were actually good defenders.
There was a year or two where you thought maybe Matt Kemp would fit the bill. And then his sort of fielding mediocrity kind of got exposed, I think.
I would say, though, at his peak.
Yeah, it's tough because like those early injuries really like. Most of his career, he was known as sort of a subpar or par defender. But there was those early years where, he's obviously extremely fast, and that really helped him in the outfield.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time actually, remembering, and then trying to figure out, some of the ones who had, the best, arms in the outfield, maybe. Or, I don't know. It's probably Mondesi and Puig and Kemp. And after that, it's weird. Rick Monday, in a weird way, he was older when he came to the Dodgers, so maybe not, but he sort of had all the skills too, but I don't necessarily put them all together with them. Plus he was hurt, a little more often, so maybe not. I don't know. Maybe I don't know much about Davey Lopes' defense, but he did have 28 home runs in 1979, and he was a great fielder and decent enough hitter. That's probably not five tools. So yeah, that's a tough one. I don't know.
Next question is for me.
Yeah.
Jacob, I wanted to know if you were able to wire your new house in a way to get good Wi-Fi service in most parts of the home. If so, do you have any tips for those of us who have their blind spots in their homes? So Craig did not know this, but he probably could have guessed. I deep dived into this in my new house because I didn't want to deal with a lot of the wiring stuff after furniture had moved in. So the answer is it depends mostly on the size of your house and then the structure of the house. My house isn't too big, but it is three stories with a basement. And because of that, I didn't think a solution that would work for most people is buying a really, really good centralized router and just making sure to put it in the middle of your house. That should get you pretty good connection elsewhere. Alternatively, you could try to put it in part of the house where you could wire, say, the entertainment center or a computer, because wired is always going to be just much, much, much faster. But because I had the three stories, putting it in the middle of the house would mean my office in the basement downstairs, which is also where the modem was, so that was going to be an issue, would be iffy at best. And I, with my work, I can't have iffy internet, and get things done. So I went with a line called the Unify from a company called Ubiquiti, which the idea being is you have a centralized wherever your modem is, and you have just a bunch of individual components that you have to have an electrician kind of wire different little access points. But it's very high quality hardware, but it's probably overkill for anybody that isn't sort of a hobbyist, server hobbyist like I am. Like I have a wall-mounted server rack in my basement that holds all this equipment, which is complete overkill, and I don't actually need it, but I wanted to have it. People who don't care and just want good Wi-Fi in a decent house, any decent mesh Wi-Fi setup should work. The Wirecutter from New York Times will have recommendations, so I should take a picture and send you my server rack, Eric. It's overdone.
I like it. No, I like that stuff. I will say this, I just live in a small apartment, and I just have Spectrum is my internet provider and my cable operator as well. But the internet was out briefly this week, and there was a scary moment, because as you know, I also rely on the internet for my job. And there was a point where I called Spectrum to get technical support and got the always encouraging message of, "We're too busy to take any further calls. Please try our site," and whatever it was. And I went on the site, and that site wouldn't load. So I was stuck in a loop of no support. But then within, I would say, a half hour, it was back. So but there was, I got worried a little bit, but yeah. fun times.
Third question is, I think the only other thing I mentioned briefly, but if you are wiring, call an electrician, get an estimate on wiring from router to spot that's sort of sucky, and either putting an additional access point there or just wiring whatever device that isn't getting good internet. That's the best thing you can do. Mm-hmm. Third question. What has been your initial impression of the three batter rule for pitchers?
It's hard to say. Like, it seems like you could work around it if you're bringing in batter or bringing in pitchers like mid inning, because if they finish the inning, that you could take them out. But generally, Adam Kolarik has been getting more opportunities, like longer, and he's actually looked pretty good to date. Because that was sort of a concern, like they might just used him more as a specialist last year. But I think it's one of those things where it's not as limiting as it sounds like it is, just because of the ending of inning rule and things. But there are situations where I think we saw this in the Giants series. They lost the last two games where on the Sunday game, there were instances where the inning that Sam Coonrod pitched, which is just a fun last name to say, he's right-handed. And I just remember that game, the Dodgers like did not go to like any of their left-handed pinch hitters, including Jock Peterson. And there was a point early in that inning where I believe AJ Pollock and Austin Barnes were allowed to bat against the right-hander, and it was within Coonrod's first three hitters. So normally a situation where in the eighth inning, there were situations where you could have pinch hit as well, but it would have meant the Giants bringing in a lefty because the pitcher had already faced three batters. But I think it creates for situations where, you know, you can exploit it from the batting side. The other thing is the Dodgers specifically have, they haven't always done this in the past, but they've alternated right left just about throughout their lineup every game. And to try to avoid those situations while batting. So that's something. I guess that's probably the main takeaway is the lineups have been sort of optimized for that. So that's probably the biggest takeaway so far.
I actually really like it. I think it reduces the number of strategic moves a manager makes per game, but I don't think it's actually decreased the nuances of strategy, because before it was just good left-hand hitter, bring in good left-hand pitcher, and that was it. It's kind of simplified, and this has more strategy of like, well, they have two good lefties, but they have this really good righty in the middle. Is it worth doing it? I think it's actually interesting. I don't necessarily miss the one and done, two commercial breaks within 1 minute situation. So this is the one rule change that I think is. It's not all good, but I think it's overall a net win, and I expect to and am looking forward to carrying over, unlike, I think, almost every other rule change we're dealing with right now.
Yeah, you're right. Like, it's one of those where I don't know if it's cut down on, like, the time or anything like that, but just from, I think, generally, like, anything that, like, gets fewer pitchers, like, pitching changes is probably better. So, like, in that respect, I like it.
The fourth question, assuming the season continues, who do you think will be the two players taken off the roster when it goes from 30 to 28? So I know you mentioned that this actually might get extended, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if that move were to occur at any point in the season, who do you think it would be?
So Terrence Gore was barely used, and he got designated for assignment.
Really frustrated that he was pinch ran for Guerin in an extra inning game before it went to extra innings. I realized the players that made the last out weren't ones you would necessarily pinch run for, but I was still really hopeful that's something we would have gotten to see.
Also, when he was brought into that game, he was brought in as a pinch runner at third, which is like the least effective way to use a pinch runner, you know, like you're not gonna like it doesn't increase like scoring on a single, you know. Whereas if it's from second, he's like clearly scoring on most singles, maybe an infield single. No. But like from third, it's like, you know, I guess there's situations where he's going to improve your chances, but it seems like that's the point where you need the least help to score, from a speed standpoint, I guess. So that was, yeah, that was a little underwhelming. I think, like, given how good Rios has been, that, and then they like the other group, when it goes down to 28, so I think they'll keep, they use Gore to bring up an extra pitcher. So their split is 13-17 right now. So I think it would just go to 13-15 at that point. So I think they lose two pitchers, and then the low man on the totem pole, Victor Gonzalez, almost certainly. And then it really depends. So they brought up Mitch White today to take Gonsolin's spot. But he's almost certainly going to be optioned for tomorrow when they bring up Kershaw. By the way, Clayton Kershaw is pitching Sunday. I think at that point it's like, you know, it could be Dennis Santana, who's kind of the long man out there now, or one of them. I don't know. I guess because, you know, you figure Dustin May is going to stay in the rotation because Wood's out. It's probably like Victor Gonzalez and Dennis Santana would be my guess. But like, yeah, that's just a guess at this point.
Final question. I know Eric is a pretzel fan, but how do both feel about pretzel-style bread or pizza crust? And I can't forget pretzel-wrapped hot dogs. Any of those work for you?
I love it all.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same. So, maybe not on pizza. I'm gonna backtrack a little bit and say I wouldn't hate that, but I don't think it would be an additive.
The only time I've had it on pizza is at Pizza Hut because it's one of the crusts they offer, like a specialty crust. And it's fine. Like, you know, it's not like, oh man, you got to have this. It's like, it's goodish, you know, I guess. I love, so every once in a while, a weak moment, I'll go to Wiener Schnitzel and just craving a chili dog. It's, you know, it's rancid meat, but whatever. There goes that sponsorship. I do like because you can make any like hot dog there a pretzel dog and just put it in a pretzel bun, and so I like their pretzel buns there. They don't always sell the pretzel buns at like my local grocery stores. You have to like go to like a Whole Foods or a Trader Joe's to find those, but I do like things on a pretzel bun every now and then, and just pretzels in general are good. So like, yeah. The other thing is Dodger Stadium, back when people were allowed there, and they sold concessions and food, their Wetzel's Pretzels has it's a pretzel dog, but all it is like a big hot dog that's just like wrapped in a sort of pretzel-y concoction. It's not quite a corn dog, and it's more like a hot dog, but it's not like, it doesn't cover like the ends of the dog. It's just more like a wrapping around it, but I like that a lot. Almost anything, basically. I love it. Love pretzels.
Same thing. I normal pretzel, I find a big soft pretzel with just mustard a little bland for me. I would want a little bit of that, but eating a whole one is just a little starchy. But if it comes with any other dipping sauce, I'm almost always a big, big fan.
I like it.
I want one really bad now with like cheese, or jalapeno cheese or something like that.
I'm tempted to, like, malls aren't really like open for that stuff right now, but like that, you just want to like walk through a mall food court and just figure it out.
I did work at an Annie Ann's for 4 months.
Whoa.
It's the only job I have been let go of.
Oh.
I wasn't up to snuff for great aunt. Aunt
oh,
aunt.
No. That's shame. Bad. So I was thinking about this. We talked about how like it's still so early in the season. So our first podcast of the season, we talked about one game, and then the next time we talked about the next three. This time we've had four to talk about. So like we just keep increasing. So like next week when we record again, we're going to have like almost a full week probably to talk about.
Hopefully.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It could be shut down at any moment. Who knows? But yeah, so yeah, it's going
to
be.
One ending note, going back to the five tool question, I've been doing Googling. I have five names I want to throw on the list of either, and I say either. So one name real quick, Duke Snyder, should be mentioned. As just a easy I took Craig's question to mean more sort of in our era that we could have watched, but I don't think it was actually explicitly said, so before people tweet at us angry, belongs in there. And then four names of players who at one point in their career at least were five tools, not so much with the Dodgers, although one I think you could probably argue for, Hanley Ramirez, Bobby Abreu, Andrew Jones, and Reggie Smith.
Yeah, and I would say, too, Ricky Henderson.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, and obviously they had him when he was, like, 64. so,
I mean, I have to, like, obviously not my era. I'd have to do a little research, but at least on the stat sheet, Reggie Smith also fits the bill while on the Dodgers. And certainly I would say his career. So. Hanley, Bobby, and Andrew, not so much. But at one point, they were, and they did play for the Dodgers. So,
yeah. And like, Reggie Smith, also one of the underrated great hitters in Dodger history. Like, just generally. Yeah, good stuff. So, I think we covered it all. So, yeah.
We've talked about everything.
Yeah. Yeah, who knows what next week's going to bring, man. It's been a weird season. But thanks for listening, everybody. We will talk to you at some point.